ListenUpNorth.com and Writers Block North East present the winners of the Middlesbrough Transporter Bridge Centenary Writing Competition.
Fear and Fallen in Port Clarence, written and read by Michael Cale. I hear a voice drifting towards me. It's telling me to let go, to flex my fingers 200 and scarily odd feet above the tarmac of Industrial Teesside, and give myself to the air and the elements. From a distance, the bridge is an iridescent blue smudge against the fairy-like glow of Teesside. Up close, my hands sweat against the unforgiving steel, flaking rust and paint. Is the bridge shaking, or is that me? The voice is more urgent now, close by my ear. It urges me to let go. So I do. I drop through the air, my stomach hurtling towards the tarmac. There's a snag, a catch in my middle as the rope no thicker than my arm takes a strain of my slender frame. I'm suspended like the catch of the day. The transporter bridge looms over me, the graceful gull-wing sweep of the latticework span, catching the fingers of sunlight that push through the grey canvas of sky above. The rope that slows my descent bites into the side of my neck as I twirl slowly. I glance upwards, use my hand to give me some leverage. The rope bucks and I grab on tight. It tenses against my neck, sharp cord biting into my jaw. I hold my breath and try again. The rope bucks again, but this time I move my head backwards. I'm free of the constricting pressure against my throat, yet the heat remains. I'm level with the yellow gondola as it shudders its way across the Tees, pushed outwards as though in a breeze only it can feel, above the wave peaks that carry the memories of the hundreds of ships that once cleaved their way from the foundries of the infant Hercules. Now the dockyards are silent, the warehouses a factory of ghosts. The transporter bridge stands in this graveyard of industry like the lone survivor of a bitter conflict, a beacon to the memory of a forgotten heritage. I can hear voices now, not the one that compelled me to leave go of the bridge. These are celebratory, whooping and cheering. The toy house of the Heritage Centre slides into view, so close as though to rest my feet on it. Behind me, I can hear the winding house chugging and squeaking and humming and thrumming. I touch ground. Vague figures rush towards me. One of them detaches the rope at my middle. Another frees me of the harness. Each of them mumble congratulations, yet the only sound I hear is the relief that thunders through my ears and makes my legs shake. I glance upwards as I walk away from the bridge. It seems impossibly high from down here, yet somehow I made it down. I can't even see the ledge where I clung for dear life. I can't see the two safety officers who secured my descent on the thinnest of margins. Just the jumble of girders and rivets and struts that is greater than the sum of their parts. I reach my family, a proud mother, relief father. Pause for the family album shot, certificate grasped between clammy fingers, smile shaky, relieved, soaked with adrenaline. One last glimpse at the bridge as I reach the car, looming over me, over Teesside, proud and stark. A tiny black thread twists against the grey canvas of sky, and another descent begins. Rather them than me.
Big Blue, written and read by Alison Davis. Blue parentheses, arms wide around the T's. Seen it all, standing firm while bombs and empires fall. You carry cars and secrets, safe in your belly, big as a whale, asking nothing. Beautiful bridge over troublesome times, keeping the faith, steel fingers a cradle for sky. Meccano smile lights up the night, guiding wanderers home.
Happy Birthday, Stan Porter. Written by Pat Brudenell and read by Bonnie Hibbs. It felt good to be back in the area. I was going to spend some time with friends in Darlington. Their grandson, Nicholas, was staying with them, and I had been asked to entertain for one morning as they attended some family business. Nicholas was just 5 years old and always enthusiastic about everything. He didn't need any encouragement to do the smallest of things. Put the words special or magical into the equation and he was all yours. I had read something about the 100th anniversary of the transporter bridge. It had been some years since my last crossing. My daughter must have been 6 or 7 at the time, and she found the experience so exciting she could hardly speak. Would Nicholas feel the same? Well, young man, how about going to see the Stan Porter Bridge? He looked at me quizzingly across the table. I think you mean transporter, Auntie Pat, not Stanporter. Amy had always referred to it as the Stanporter. It started when she was very young on a visit to Grandma North in Stockton. Like many children's mispronunciations, it had stayed. It settled comfortably along other words. Ambience for ambulance. Elliance for elephants. All families hold on to such treasures. Is it special then? Oh, very special. If it's special, does this mean it's magic? Nicholas finished off his cereal, put his spoon on the table and waited for the right answer. Well, I suppose it could be. I used to think so when I was your age. Nicholas went to make some urgent adjustments to his toy garage while I cleared the table. As I put together the required bag of essentials necessary to accompany any child on a trip out, I recalled some hidden memories from more than half a century before. As a child, I'd skated. Sometimes, on a Sunday evening, my dad would take me, Mum, and my sister to the skating rink at Haverton Hill. I loved any outgoing in our peppermint green Hillman minks. The bench seats made the car seem bigger than it actually was. Of course, Haverton Hill was such a long way from Stockton in the 1950s. Whilst I was always excited about skating, what made Haverton Hill Rink so special was the fact that something so big, so grand, so completely enormous as the Transporter, probably the biggest thing I'd ever seen, could, in the blink of an eye, just disappear. One minute it was there, and the next it was gone. With each side of approaching roads flanked by industry, there was just the faintest glimpse of the bridge. As the car turned into the car park, there was no sign of it. Yet, later, when we sat on the doorstep to the building, waiting for all parents to say endless goodbyes, she was there, in all her green majesty. How did that happen? Every time I asked my dad for an explanation, his consistent response was that the bridge was special and magical. It was enough. So there we were. Decades had passed, and much of the landscape was now unrecognisable. Obviously, some things were still the same. Pinky and Perky stood tall and proud, but there was a sense of industrial desert about the place. Are we nearly there yet? And what's the most special thing now, Auntie Pat? I think the most special thing is that this year it's a special birthday. Is the bridge having a party for its birthday? And will lots of people come? I think lots of people will come on every day. And when we're on the bridge, we will need to say happy birthday to the bridge. Nicholas sat safely in his seat in the back of the car. When I was his age, I could turn around and kneel up to look through the back window to catch the last glimpse of the magical bridge. I can see it! I can see it! He squealed with delight. Where's it gone? It'll be back in a minute. Keep looking. We went over the little bridge, with the Haverton Hotel on our left. It looked the same. The entrance to the shipyard on the right, where my dad had served his time, is still there. Under the bridge, and as we pulled up at the traffic lights on Hope Street Junction, I was immediately transported back in time. The waves of nostalgia were almost suffocating. It was almost as if I was in some sort of time warp. I drove along the road, past the houses and the school and the shops and the playing field, Nicholas squealing, "I can see it! I can see it! Now it's gone! Now it's back! Now it's gone!" I was reminded of return day trips home from Seaton. We would be driving along that coast road. One minute she was there, and the next she had gone. We turned past the station hotel and under the bridge. She stood before us, proud and bold. We had just missed the crossing, and I was glad. It gave us both a chance to take in the majesty of the transporter. Auntie Pat, it's blue! We were the first car to drive on the bridge on the next crossing. And, of course, the first car off. I couldn't leave without a last lingering look. As we made our way home, I was reminded of how, in an instant, we can be suddenly transported back to a place in time. A time when the world looked and was very different. I unashamedly wallowed in the feelings that this wonderful journey had afforded me. There was a tinge of guilt in that I had actually put my needs first. When we met up for lunch with his grandparents and they asked him what sort of a morning he'd had, all this changed. I saw something very special. It's a bridge that is so big, but it just disappears. It's magic!
I've Seen It All, written by Louise Kerr and read by Chris Stewart. I'm a transporter bridge standing on stilts near Millsboro. I'm tall and I've seen it all. Carriages and cars, local or far, across river walls, I've seen it all. Royal Street parties, Queen's Jubilee, crown withdrawals, I've seen it all. Suffragette marches, crossing charges, air raid calls, I've seen it all. Decades of fashion, World War ration, buildings crumble, I've seen it all. Miniskirt creation, mods in moderation, songs rise and fall, I've seen it all. Running late workers, courtroom shirkers, fans of football, I've seen it all. Filmed on TV, Auf Wiedersehen tease, audition recall, I've seen it all. Centenary celebrations for one in a nation, spring, summer, fall, I've seen it all. Sadness or laughter, my happily ever after, from my spot on the tees, I've lots more to see.
The Bridge of Steel, written by Ben Bone and read by Adele Millward.
The Bridge of Steel, that's what he called it. The Bridge of Steel, it's hardly the Eiffel Tower, I thought. But then he was hardly Jason Donovan, and I had a perm like Sonia's. It was 1989. I was dishing out bacon butties in Dickie's Cafe down by the river. Didn't pay much, but the crack was good and gave me a bit of extra cash in my pocket to hit the Madison after college on a Friday. Anyway, I'd finish my shift and he'd always be there, on the banks of the river, sketching. I mean, come on, maybe down London, but on the banks of the Tees? I thought he was a bit of a perv at first. I mean, some of the lasses that used to come in for a fried egg bun on a morning were hardly the most legit of workers, if you get my drift. So I just assumed he was hanging about for one of them. Though, as time went by, he'd catch my eye. There'd be a nod, then a smile. And then one day, when it was pissing down, he came into the cafe and ordered a ham roll and a black coffee. I told him he was in Borough now. We have buns, not rolls. He apologised, dead sheepish, never said anything else. Then a few days later, he was there again, etching away in his big pad on the riverside, like Rolf Bleeding Harris. Sod it, I thought, and I asked him for a nosy. I don't know what I was expecting. Some beautiful bird over the river or a floating flower on the water. You know, the sort of thing your nana has hanging in the hallway. But it was just the bridge. Is that it? He smiled at me and asked me to look at it. I pulled a face, but he insisted. What do you see? Well, duh, it's just the tranny bridge. What's to see? He scribbled something on a scrap of paper and slipped it into my hand. 6 p.m. by the Bridge of Steel, Middlesbrough side, don't be late. I looked up, but he was off and racing down the path, as if I was going to meet a complete stranger on the transporter bridge on a freezing cold night. He could be a murdering rapist. I wasn't daft. I'd seen the bill. I didn't even know his name. Although, when I showed our mum the note, her only comment was, oh, what a lovely hand he has. But I couldn't get him out of my head. There was something about him. He wasn't your usual tracking wear in Scally. He had a bit of class. I mean, was there really any harm? So, I went. Must have been crazy when I think about it. Stood on the riverbank in a miniskirt and stone-washed denim jacket. You could see your breath so clearly in the frosty night. Everyone looked like they were just walking fags. Thankfully, it was busy. Rush hour. and the bridge was lit up bright blue. I thought if he tried anything, everyone would be able to see. And I could just knee him in his area and chuck him over the edge. Youth. Anyway, I saw him approaching in the distance. My tummy flipped a little. God, he was cute. He smiled when he saw me and, without saying anything, reached out and took my hand. He led me onto the bridge, paid, of course, a gent, and we stood staring out over the river in silence. Our eyes kept catching, and after a while he pointed at the water and asked what I thought. I told him it was the dirty river, probably filled full of Presto trolleys and old boots. He laughed and told us to look again. He nodded at the lights from the bridge reflecting off the water. He said something about them dancing with the ripples. Well, I'd certainly never thought about it like that before. But he was right. I looked out at the twinkling lights from the industry, all that pollution. He said it was painting the night sky a different shade of colour every minute. I'd never met anyone who could look at life and see the ordinary as something so beautiful. I turned, and he was watching me. It was as if he was seeing something different, almost analysing every inch of me. And then he leaned in and kissed me. The cheeky git planted one right on my lips, on a bridge in the middle of the River Tees. And you know what? I kissed him back. And for a second, there was just me and him and all the dancing ripples and the colourful sky and that winter mist whirling around us. But then reality kicks in and you realise cars are beeping and pointing and laughing. And we laughed. I wish I could say it was the romance of the century, Burra's answer to Scott and Charlene. But he had to leave the next week to go travelling. And after the odd letter and postcard, life slowly got in the way. College, work, marriage, kids, divorce. But I always thought of him every time I saw that bridge. And I'd smile, remembering. The kids would ask why I loved the bridge so much, huffing and puffing every time I took them on it. I never told them. It was my moment. Then one day, my youngest came home from the school fair with a load of second-hand junk. Great. But in the middle of it was this painting. I almost dropped it when I spotted his name and his fine hand etched into it. And then my heart stopped. The picture was a girl looking at a bridge. The bridge was the transporter, and the girl, well, it was me.
Metal Colossus in Blue. Written by Irene Stiles and read by Bonnie Hibbs. Way, way up there, touching the sky, with your metal fingers icy and blue, you sparkle and shine against the black skyline. What stories through the years must you have to tell? Straddling the Tees, like the Colossus of Rhodes, 1911 to present day. A meeting place for lovers' trysts, workers, tourists, people on a visit to your highest place, climbing, abseiling from your peaks, raising money for good causes, the helpless and our soldier forces. Your fame has spread far and wide, biggest working transporter bridge worldwide. Now, waiting for a facelift of improved flooring and glass lifts soaring, such a busy place of yesteryear. Now the workplace and workforce around you is almost dead, leaving only Vulcan memories. Impartial walls, brick red, iron, pottery, salt, shipbuilding all gone. Nearby, the clock tower, hands missing, stands formidable. As time rolls on and desolation is all around, the water sparkles below you. A boat tipped like a drunken sailor lolls on its side. Lying disabled and discarded, no more a nightclub where people laughed and danced the night away. Only seabirds provide the disco music now. And the waves lap its rusty hulk. Across the water, on both sides, stand concrete towers and blackened chimney stacks spewing and belching still. Flames and smoke, like a lacklustre dragon, filling air and nostrils with sulphur fumes. This place once filled with cap-clad men, in work clothes grim, walking and cycling to work or home, filling the busy transporter bridge, going back and forth, driven by the winching crew. Cycles slung over riders' shoulders, cheaper to climb the metal steps, saves pennies for the day. Walking the length of the metal blue, no fear of heights allowed, and God, what a view. Further down the river, once dockland filled with boats and ships, seamen going about their business of the day, later seeking satisfaction with the dock girls of the night. All this gone, lost in the swirling mists of time. With loss of jobs, loss of pay and heritage mislaid. But walking down once busy Vulcan Street, seen in the distance is another giant mass of iron and sparkling mesh. A Diablo balanced on rods of steel. A work of art, Temerus by name, keeping the blue transporter encircled in its frame and sings when the wind blows through. It represents all that's new. Teesside regenerating, mixing old with new. And all of this change, the transporter blue, silently keeps an overview.
Retirement, written and read by Ben Frew. I read somewhere that Albert Einstein once conceptualised his understanding of time by suggesting that when travelling by rail, you shouldn't ask the conductor when the train will arrive at the station, rather when the station will arrive at the train. Time, he said, has no centre. I understand what he meant when I'm aboard this platform. On some days, it seems to hang motionless while all the clockwork of the universe orbits around it. A celestial timepiece waiting for some inconceivable moment to come to an end. It hovers over the water as one bank and then the other pull themselves toward it. Then it rudely leaves go, and the other bank slides in to receive the rickety bicycles and dusty flat caps, and all of the mute atoms in between. The architects call this platform a gondola, an aspirational non sequitur of a name, vulgar and inappropriate on this brutish river. I call it the cradle. It has held me still and secure as the world has rushed along manically outside of its embrace. It has clung to me, has been my protector. My father was one of them that built this monster, pulled that steel into a bipedal giant and placed it over the river like the thighs of Hercules. And it was a Herculean effort to build, make no mistake. The sweat and saliva of 1,000 men drew the oar and cast it, riveted it and aligned it, dammed it and admired it. I came to work on the platform at 16 years of age, sent here by my father, who said it was a damn good position for one so young. It was easy work as he saw it, and it was. Waving people on, locking the gates, blowing the whistle, it was damn good. 50 or more times a day I've blown that whistle. I've felt at times like an Old Testament prophet, telling the stars when to move and when to hold their breath. 50 times a day for 57 years. But my work here is over now. I have to step off my cradle for good. This is the last time I'll tell the world to do anything at all. Certainly, it's the last time that I'll have any say in the starting or the stopping of this town's toil and tumult. The sky, as always, is Teesside grey, a smoky, dull gunmetal which chokes the air and engulfs the sun. Crows the size of buzzards are peering down from the cantilever, cawing sardonically like a Greek choir, mocking the absurdity of my pride. When I blow the whistle now, my final trip will begin. And as this platform suspends itself, dances calmly in its own eternal corner of the heavens, I will enter for the final time into what Einstein described as the state of a hanging star, an imperceptible, unconscious stillness at the centre of its own gravity, where the past and the present collide and become one.
Somewhere Different, written and read by Helen Victoria Anderson. We are showing the London cousins their roots. They are staying at Granny's and we are condensing months of plans into 4 hyperactive days. We have done fish and chips, the pier, the beach, the valley gardens, saved the museum in reserve in case the weather did its usual, but it is behaving so far. It is teasing us playing mind games with ominous black clouds silhouetted against the weak sun. Soft-voweled southern city dwellers, they are used to a different kind of urban, hot, dusty pavements and bustling congas of harassed commuters, soaring glass prisms and escalators descending into tiled tunnels. Here, we have made a different impression on the landscape. Miles of grey lines and green curves stabbed by chimneys and threaded with pipelines. You have the Thames and we have the Tees, I tell my curly mopped nephew in my best educational but fun voice. At 4 and a half, he is the family's eternal baby. He gazes upwards at the beams and wires, bending so far backwards that I'm afraid the gusts of cool river wind might flip him over the gondola's side. Don't let that word fool you. This is definitely not Venice. No sun-bleached terracotta palaces or musical ice cream snatchers here, though the ticket man might whistle us a tune. He is amiable and efficient in his black weatherproof separates with flashes of fluorescent. My daughter, teetering on the precipice of adolescence, announces it's her first time too. She's seen the Blue M many times as a backdrop to cinema trips and football matches, but she has never actually used it. She is usually right about these things, but she must have been on the transporter before. What kind of mother would I be if I denied her this on our very doorstep? I try to pinpoint the exact occasion, but the nearest I come is an early attempt, aborted by unseasonal squalls. An abrupt halt at the closed sign. We went a very long way round that day. She is right again. Memories of this bridge belong to her older brother. We have left him at home today to study for the exams which will decide his future. How far from the nest he will fly come September. I wonder if he has prized himself out of bed yet. My son was the original grandchild, the only one for 6 precious years. Much fitter, younger grandparents treated him to after-nursery excursions, keen to show him life's ropes and provide free, flexible childcare, while I tried to find myself via a clerical job in the office block by the flyover. This morning, we set off early in convoy up the road from the coast, strapped into car seats and safety belts. My husband drove his ex-company car. I followed in my faithful runabout, which nearly stalled in shock when we veered away from Middlesbrough's myriad of shopping opportunities and turned under the Albert Bridge. Past Customs House, venturing into the unknown, or at least the almost forgotten. We drifted through asphalted lanes, bordered by determined rows of renovated and dilapidated dwellings, rusted warehouses and enterprising workshops set among gravelly, unmarked plots. Again, we reached the end of the earth. This time, we are in luck. No long diversion is necessary today, just the patience to queue. I have learned plenty about patience lately. We switched our engines off. The other side is tantalisingly close, so near, yet so far. Next to a gleaming smoked glass coach, a group of tanned pensioners sporting navy blazers and neatly permed wives view the structure from far enough away so as not to crick their arthritic necks. Like the giant Meccano model they have paused to admire, they are not museum pieces just yet. The open tread steps bring Eiffel Tower queues and Boston fire escapes to mind. I was once evacuated from a hotel at 2 a.m. If it hadn't been a false alarm, my dithering on the emergency staircase would have had all the guests frazzled alive. These steps are the stuff of my nightmares. My neighbour walked over the top of the bridge last year to raise money for her son's football team. Well, you do anything for your kids, don't you? Her rhetorical question sent me on a guilt trip. I'd be hard pushed to shuffle across the top for £1 million, never mind to pay for new goal nets. I love my children a lot, but I hate heights a lot too. We nose onto the platform and edge into the snug parking places. Handbrakes pulled firmly on, we pile out onto the deck. My daughter clutches her little cousin's hands and follows advice not to lean on the gates. The wind-rippled green water below is churned by a speedboat filled with orange-vested, whooping figures. We wait for it to pass, and then we clunk forward like a mechanised version of Please, Mr. Crocodile. Our progress is smooth, uninterrupted. My nephew is amazed. Look where we've come from, all that way. We look out over the wilderness of wide-open industrial spaces, abandoned but clinging doggedly to life. His jaw drops in horror at the sinking nightclub ship. He must think his bonkers granny and blunt northern aunt have brought him on a day trip to a disaster zone. We assure him no one needs rescuing. I hope we're right. I join Mum back in the car. She is nithered, son or no son. We dock. I'm sure there are technical terms for all this. We clunk click and restart our engines and roll off in an orderly manner. We have made it. There is no need to fake excitement for the sake of the little ones. We follow the signs through swaying grasslands which man has reclaimed for nature. We are here to see the birds. Dad's binoculars lie in Mum's lap. I wish my dad could have held on long enough to see his youngest, cherubic grandson. We could have all been transported together.
We Shall Be, written and read by Helen Steadman. Deep down, in a dark place, fast asleep in the bedrock, precious jewels, praying, casting spells, Eremus, oh Eremus, whispering wishes, never dreaming of the aerial angel drawn in blue filigree that we would become, this distant, fragile beauty, delicate fingertips outstretched for a kiss in the middle, trailing tendrils in the teas, graceful cat's cradle, while wind sighs in the sinews of the yellow steel gondola sailing, we resist the siren lure of Sister Bridges, to stand, sentinel, sole survivor. Siblings lost cleave to ancient land, their iron draws us, molecule by molecule, back to the dark womb.
Ladislav's Love, written by Rebecca Pearl, read by Chris Stewart. Ladislav is woken by a snort. Mary has worked her way over to his side of the bed again. Her head is angled back so that her rancid, gaping mouth is right by his nose. He can feel the warm moisture of her breath with every laboured exhalation she makes. He's rigid, terrified to move in case he wakes her. There's nowhere to move anyway. Right on the edge of the bed he is. Any further he'd be on the carpet. It takes a while for him to place the feelings she provokes in him. Then he realises with some regret that it's repulsion. Utter repugnance. He looks past the bulk to the alarm clock. 6:54. It's not even 7 and already he's knotted up with negativity. It's not Mary, it's him. Is this what he'll say to her? Ladislav has fallen in love with someone else. She is all he can think about. He's giddy. He wakes in the night aching for her. It's not just a flash in the pan either. They met 5 years earlier when, after watching her from afar, he'd forced himself to go closer. Closer until they were touching. She had stretched out, exposed in front of Ladislav, and he finally had understood the meaning of the word. She was beautiful, defiant, and it was with a heavy heart he left that day to return home to Mary. Mary snorts again and shuts her mouth. He can hear her dry tongue running over dry teeth and it makes him feel sick. Enough, Ladislav tells himself. Today is the day. No more excuses. He needs to see his lover first, though. Tell her he's leaving Mary. He backs out of the bed and pads to the bathroom where he washes and shaves as quickly as he can. He allows himself an extra splash of aftershave. He thinks he can hear Mary's voice calling out as he closes the front door behind him. but he's not sure. He wheels his bike from around the back of the house and he's off. Freedom. By the time he reaches Durham Street, the wind is trying to hold him back, return him to where he belongs. The thought of hair keeps him going. He needs some motivation. It's taken an age to get anywhere. He pedals hard with his head down. It's cold, but he's sweating across his back. His eyes are streaming. When he's blinked the tears away, there she is, looking at him with her baby blues. Her beauty still has the power to wind him. She has stoically endured lashings from the waters, a bomb hit, and gales trying to blow her down. Yet she is still standing strong. Like him, she's a survivor. Ladislav approaches slowly, savouring the anticipation. As he strokes her side, he knows he can trust her steely solidity to cradle him from the hungry waters below. He is ready for 2.5 minutes of heaven with his beloved tranny.